I have a very interesting piece of news. If the newspapers in Los Angeles are correct, newspapers are newspapers. And I always quote them hesitantly. I can tell you this, newspapers are much more secure quoting me than I am quoting them. But, and this is deadly serious, I did not really relish the idea of getting on demonology. Not handled properly, it could be called playing with fire. And I've talked of doing it for years. In fact, some of you will remember it was several years before I finally would teach on Revelation. You do not expose Satan, and I believe in him, without stirring things up. Just know that. One of my complaints with the modern revival charismatic frame is they reduce Satan down to a size they can deal with. It doesn't pay to reduce God, to reduce righteousness, or to reduce Satan. They're what they are. And we're caught in between. Very few Christians realize that evil forces have a hierarchy. Jesus could send 70 out, and every demon they encountered, they just knocked them off. Came back rejoicing. Even the demons are subject to us. Yet when he came down from the Mount of Transfiguration, there was a little boy possessed of demon there, they couldn't exercise. Jesus said, this kind, as though there's different kinds, cometh forth with much fasting and prayer. And then I share an old-fashioned idea, though probably I deal with it better than most people, that a little knowledge is worse than no knowledge at all. Now, I'm forever on television dealing with subjects more profound than some people think an average audience of any kind should deal with. That's why in college and university you have prerequisites. You have a certain course before you have another course. And several prerequisites before you have some courses. I'm told, I'd need to have this confirmed, but I'm told that the Roman Catholic Church, for example, will only teach on some subjects of exorcism and demons at certain seminaries and at the universities in Rome. It wouldn't surprise me if that's true. And Jesus cloaked certain truths and parables. So I've put off this subject a long time. Lots of reasons. But one of the reasons is I know when you invade his territory, he fights. Now, I don't want to elevate this fact out of proportion. And it may not even be true because we haven't confirmed it in Amarillo. But I was saying last night, without knowing, that Amarillo had become a target where I believe that Satan, if he can block our forward move there, it's like times we've raised money when a certain number, we've got to cross it, or the last few miles or inches are the most important in the fight. And though all my reasoning ability and business ability told me we should leave Amarillo because of a lack of response. 22nd of October, $362. When Lubbock, I wonder where Lubbock is tonight. Let me just pause a minute to find out. Yeah, Lubbock, 39, 33. That's where they were last night. And Amarillo, where was it last night? 372. I said 362, didn't I? It's 372 tonight. Just dead right there. Now, every business judgment says don't stay in Amarillo. But when I made the decision, I have to credit it with a spiritual impetus. Every part of my bone marrow says, no! If Satan wins there, we'll be on the defensive. And I like to stay on the offensive. And I feel like our real battle is going to be in Amarillo and New York City. 372 dollars. I asked 100 people last night to help me to slap the devil in the teeth. And over and above everything else they're going to give in October, just write a check for $372. And I had 20 last night. I got 80 to go. 80 more people, and I'm going to get them this week. I'm going to have 100 people give $372 above the rest of their offering just to say to Satan, now, which one are you going to try next time? Because I think the figures will be larger when we get to New York or someplace like that. If he makes me mad enough, whatever the figure is, I'm going to go for 100 people giving it. I found out, and I told you, among other things, Satan's been attacking us because I've been teaching on demonology. Among other things, I found out that either the National or the International Witches Convention is scheduled in Amarillo, October 31st, Halloween. Now, you can read whatever you want into that. What's so ironic? If I had known that Saturday, before I made the business judgment on Sunday, I wouldn't even have needed a spiritual impetus to stay in Amarillo. I would have sure stayed there through the 31st, teaching on demonology. Now, some would say, I have 10 years behind me that enables me to get on a sensational subject without anybody who really knows me daring to accuse me of playing the sensational. But I don't do that. And most of the things I've been reading to you, I don't believe. But I do. You understand that? They're impossible. But they aren't. They can happen. But they are happening. Now, I have 10 years' record. Pull out the tapes. I have told you. That New England is the graveyard of evangelists. I've been misunderstood by some people in New England. But I think 9 years proves a commitment and a love and a concern. And there are wonderful people in New England. The ones that support us are there night or day, thick or thin. And New England is now a positive, contributing part of our network. And I said 9 years ago, knew him and needed me, because I doubt anybody else would have stuck it out. There are lots of people in New England that weren't born there. This has nothing to do with the people. It has to do with the biblical principle. The prince of this world is Satan. We, through the power of the Spirit, the church of the living God, is at war with him, and he's at war with us. And we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And with the help of him who is greater in us than he that's in the world, the war ebbs and flows. In some territories, Satan's hold has been broken. Other territories, Satan's hold is stronger. If anything came out of my many years as an itinerant teacher of the Word, I learned that. I used to have people look at me like I was weird. But I would go into cities where I was going to preach a week, and I would fly in 2 or 3 days before the meeting, alone, and just walk the streets of the city, night and day, preparing, among other things, for the week to come. And unlike some people who would quit on Sunday and start on Monday, I'd usually have a week between Sundays. And I'd say, cities have personalities. You walk streets of Chicago, you feel something totally different than when you walk the streets of Dallas. Or you walk streets of New York City, and it doesn't feel like Sydney, Australia. Cities have personalities. And then to the people, it's a felt personality. I feel it. You see, you've got strange vibrations. Well, okay, I've got strange vibrations. It's one of the pains I have when I preach. I can feel the audience. It's the pain that's on my voices of faith. Whatever you do in here affects. Because I can't be an unconscious preacher. I feel everything. And our best times are when a kind of super consciousness develops. To where I'm at one with the camera, I feel the life that's out there, I'm at one here, and believe you me, my crew, that's why an ordinary union-type crew wouldn't work with us. They know that. And once that mystical click occurs, doesn't matter what happens. I mean, light can fall off, a piano fall over. You can get up and go to the restroom. I can still keep it going. But until that click comes that binds, just binds the atmosphere, we're fine. I feel when I cross the city limits of Glendale. I don't know why God always assigns me places like that, but Glendale is one of the toughest cities for God to genuinely work in the entire Los Angeles basin. It's a felt thing. I'm here, you know. God didn't sign me to where it feels good. And we are breaking that barrier. And as some of you know, that an attitude toward our church began to change at the same time some other things changed as we fought forward in faith. Now, I've said for 9 years, New England has problems. It is not the people. It's not the geography. New England is a prize. It was the fountainhead of liberty. It was the fountainhead of religion in this country. And it's a prize that Satan wanted. And great revival came to that northeast part of our country. But something happened. Some of it was materialism, but what it was, on whether it was intellectualism that backlashed against the great universities founded with religious purposes in the area. But my Bible says that if you drive a demon out and you open the door for him to come back, you get seven more just like him and brings him back. The repossession state is many times over the original state. What it takes to wrestle a demon from a place the first time is much less than when you have to get him out next time. And every city has got its princes of the power of the air assigned, and only the power of God working through favors ever makes inroads and breaks that hold. I said, look, the same energy took so much longer to bear fruit in New England. And he said, what are you leading up to? Well, I don't want to make anybody mad in New England. I care. I'm there. I teach Christian realism. And I'm saying, have you noticed, as I get on these demon stories, these strange, unbelievable stories in New England? He said, well, the houses are older there. I mean, I'll say that. I mean, that's one thing I love about New England. I'm a my undergraduate major is history. I can't drive a mile without stopping to study something. I mean, the demons in Los Angeles got to keep a bag packed all the time because here today, gone tomorrow. We have no historic buildings. We tear them down every day. There is no site so sacred we don't tear it down. So you don't have a building, too many of them in Los Angeles, I guess, where somebody's been in it and opened the place to demon influence because the houses don't last more than one family. Now I'm exaggerating, you know I am. But there are all of those elements. I mean, takes the chances of a house getting haunted if such a thing is real. And I'm not sure I'm convinced yet. But what I know about haints and statistical probability, a 400-year-old house in England is more apt statistically to encounter the possibility of hainting than a 4-year-old tract home in California. So all those things may weigh in. I think the basic problem is spiritual. You know, I'll tell you something else. New England's the greatest place in the world to live politically. Town hall, democracy personified. The founders of this country recognize that sin exists, and the best way to hold sin in check is to balance power. Because they know sin's going to come out. So politically, a deep-seated tradition of democracy and everybody having their say is a way to fly. Religiously, it's anathema. The reason you can't get a revival going in New England is the people have been running things for too many years. Congregational churches, they run the pastor. They keep a pastor so emasculated and scared of his shadow he couldn't even spit at a demon. It does not foster strong religious leadership. Exception being the Catholic Church. And they're not my subject. You don't have strong spiritual leadership where the congregation calls the shots. Sorry. Well, what about these preachers that are no good? Find one that is. Nobody ties your noose to the pew just because your great-granddad paid rent on it. Or nobody ties your nose either. It's amazing to have people that know what you meant to say even when you don't say it. I mean, I had 10 spies going into the Promised Land that Sunday when everybody knows there's 12, but I had mine, the 10 that brought the bad report, you know. I just didn't want to group Caleb and Joshua with them, which is an explanation like those who explained for Reagan. That isn't true. I just faux-pawed. It said 10. I misspoke. The noose or your nose is to the pew. Simple facts are, it ain't God's way to run His work. God gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the perfecting of the saints. There ain't a scripture in the world that says any saints ever responsible to God or authorized by God to perfect any apostle, prophet, evangelist, pastor, or teacher. Sorry. Ain't your job. Well, it needs to be done. I think I can do it. Well, not on me. You just pray for God to deal with me. If you don't like me, vote me out. But I come with a yes going in and a no going out, nothing in between. So New England's got all those problems. He said, "What's this? What are you doing?" Well, one of my staff members almost got killed at midnight last night because they found it and read it. Or took it and didn't give it to me first. I appoint every person who listens to me and everybody works for me, full-time research assistants to me. If you find something on the subject, you don't read it, you burn a rut in the road to get it to me. You got that?
Yes, sir.
You ain't got time to read it. You ain't got time to read what I've pointed out to you. You ought to read where and when and in what sequence. You say, "I want to be free." Go ahead and be freely stupid, but I'm going to be mad at you. I haven't got time to do anything but sit here. Why have I got a ring in my phone? I'm in a hurry. A microphone is some form of phone. It's not a microchair, is it? It's a microphone. Not a micro camera, it's a microphone. If I'm teaching on the devil, you see a book anywhere that has the word devil in it. You don't even read it. You just buy it and send it to me. Right now. I had people at 4 o'clock running around last night, ready to hang people up by their toenails. I had a book that I didn't know about. I read it today. Taking them a month. I'm trying to help you out. And I plow through 4 or 5 of them a day. Most of them aren't worth reading. Some of them are. I'll tell you, if this book's true, the most amazing book I've ever read in all my life. It's the biggest lie of all the lies I've been reading. I never read one this big. This is absolutely the biggest. This is the biggest tale of them all. Am I boring you? Well, I should be, because I haven't said much yet. And if this is a lie, the whole world ought to sue the publishing company for fraud. It's criminal to print a book like this as truth if it isn't. So it must be true. But it can't be. There ain't no way this could be true. The devil in Connecticut. Now, that's what I've been saying for 9 years. 9 years I've been saying this. I feel so good tonight because I... Listen, all you folks in Connecticut that got us in the black, do you realize we whipped the devil? Then his fiendish being? There's got to be a lie. Simply could not be true. Now you've got your assignment, all you people. Don't ever go past the bookstore. It's going to say, Lord, speak to me. Don't ever go past the bookstore without some money in your pocket. You say, well, I gave it all to you. Get yourself a credit card. Say, I thought you didn't believe in credit. In that case, I make an exception. The devil in Connecticut. Read the thing through twice today. Said first time, couldn't be true. Second time, I thought it might convince me. When I finished the second time, I folded pages down where the really big lies are. Said that couldn't happen. Dawn, August 6, 1980. Same people are involved. Same author, Gerald Brittle, who wrote The Demonologist that I've been reading from. By Gerald Brittle, in cooperation with, because there's a double copyright on it, in cooperation with Ed and Lorraine Warren. Dawn, August 6, 1980. Help, Mommy. I'm going to let you buy a bunch of these for the bookstore, Mike, to get it from me tonight. Dawn, August 6, 1980. This is an event that happened after the Donovan House and after the Rag Doll, after West Point, and after those other stories I've been reading. Dawn, August 6, 1980. Help, Mommy. Save me. David screamed out of his sleep. David, his mother called out fearfully, but she got no answer. David, she called again, walking halfway to the bedroom, then stopping. The repugnant smell of vomit met her, and she could hear vague whisperings in the air. David! David, answer me, Judy demanded. Deep, raucous laughter suddenly issued from the boy's bedroom. Courageously, she pushed open the bedroom door, stepped across the threshold, and looked at her son. Her knees buckled. What Judy Gladwell saw, she will never, never forget. David's gone, the slow, deep voice proclaimed. His soul is mine. In February 1981, a young man with the name of Arnie Cheyenne Johnson was arrested in Connecticut and charged with murder. Under ordinary circumstances, such a crime would have been given brief mention in the local press. The matter would then have quickly faded from public view. But there was something different about this case, and within a month, the story became front-page news. Attention was focused on this particular murder because the young man claimed, in an unprecedented legal defense, and I might add, denied by the judge, that he was not guilty of the crime by virtue of diabolical possession. Oh, another one of those. The devil made me do it. What the press did not know at the time, because the essential facts were still I might say at that time, cloaked in secrecy, was that the murder actually represented the culmination of a religious case, a horrendous religious case, that had begun fully 8 months before in the town of Brookfield, Connecticut. Now, Ghostbusters, get ready. This one's going to be easier to check out, but I can tell you, that the checking will not come from the local police, except in part. It will not come from the local Catholic diocese, except in part. And if this story is true, the key priests involved were moved to Rome. This book is a reconstruction of the entire Brookfield possession case from its disturbing origin to its tragic end. Places, persons, dates, and events that are mentioned can be substantiated in the public record. The specific research data, which comprises the bulk of this text, was taken directly from the victims of the event, from the Warrens, who were the chief investigators of the case, and from photographs and tape recordings made on the scene while the preternatural phenomena were in progress. Beyond being an extraordinary attack on the typical American family by violent spirits of darkness, what ultimately makes this case unique and sets it apart from the rest is that the siege was orchestrated not by some random demonic force, but by a devil of a very high order. The result was pure iniquity. This will stand as one of the worst cases of possession to occur in the 20th century. Demon possession. Is a generic term that needs to be broken into preceding parts and subsequent events. One of the finest summations is right here. Preternatural manifestations occur in a five-step progression: encroachment, infestation, oppression, possession, and death. First occurs the encroachment, or permission stage, where a negative spirit is given access to a human being through either voluntary means, satanic rituals, or involuntary means, curses. And that doesn't mean saying damn. It means a contact with someone with capacity to curse. Some people have never met. A jungle witch doctor, for example, in his hatred. Won't know what I'm talking about. The essential point to remember is that doors have to be opened for the phenomena to occur. Leave the occult alone, your chances of having spirit problems almost nil. Next comes the infestation stage, where negative spirits physically enter the homes or lives of human beings and cause fearful phenomena. For some strange reason, the infesting entity presents itself only after making an obvious, comprehensible warning of its arrival. That's as far as I want to take it. The other three stages, that's what this book's about. Whereas the other book on demonology deals with multiple case histories. This is one story. The devil in Connecticut. I never read anything like it in my entire life. You interested?
Yes, sir.
You don't think I'm crazy? Got a book here by Kenneth Hagin on demons. That ought to tell you everything. The subject simply cannot be compressed. I'm not against Kenneth Hagin. Most of these people are known, been in and around. I'm just saying. I'm sure he has more to say on it than this subject, but that's my gripe. Some people think you can encompass this subject like that. Well, the first page is Ezekiel 28:13-19 and Isaiah 14:12-17. That's a good start. I agree with that. Second page is Matthew 12:43-45, Ephesians 6:10-14, and Mark 5:1-9. And he says, we'll not be able to cover all the scripture just given in this one book. But I wanted to give all that scripture so you'd have the scriptural background. My friend, there's a much more scriptural background than that. And he deals with some demons like type demons. He's preaching in a church. He says, the minute I stepped into the pulpit when I preached there, one time I discerned that stingy, covetous, crooked devil in that church. These spirits gang up in certain places. I just don't have anything to do with them unless I have to. I wasn't going to be there unless God told me to. So this was a church. Minister there decided to tell me some things. He said that he took the church without promise of any set salary. That he received the tithes and offerings on Sunday morning. Then the Sunday night offering would go for payments and incidental things for the church. He said he had came without understanding. He said that when he came, God began to bless them and others began to come in. When they first came, they didn't get enough to get by on it. It was just a few dollars a week. Finally, it really built up. Then the board had a meeting without the pastor and decided they were going to take the money and put it all together. They would then pay all the bills and pay the church note and whatever was left the pastor could have. The minute I stepped into the pulpit when I preached there one time, I discerned that stingy, covetous, crooked devil in that church. Pages about tightwad demons. I don't really think that you need a demon to be a tightwad. I think that comes natural. Well, The Origin and Operation of Demons is the title of this book, Kenneth Hagin. The Origin and Operations of Demons. If you want an easy, single lesson, I don't sell this book. I'm sure it can be found. Well, this is volume one of the Satan, Demons, and Demon Possession series, The Origin and Operation of Demons. Now, I've heard Ken say some good things, but I think it is tragic for the evangelical church world that a Catholic demonologist is presenting to the modern world the reality, fearlessly, of how terrible demon, devil, power work in the world can be. While the Pentecostal phenomenon that claims the fullness of the Spirit has occupied itself with fads for the last several years, from spitting demons out on napkins to now spending so much of its time worrying about demons talking backwards to us through rock records. And it's about time, and it's too hot in here. It's about time somebody deal with this subject in its reality. But I never really intended to go this far. This is the biggest lie I've ever read. Has to be. But got every indication of being totally true. And if you think what I've read to you today is scary, I think I'm going to read the exorcism to start with. You don't want me to. We have been battling the prince of the power of the air, and I don't entertain the thought that he can win. And if you stay with me as I read these stories, you have everything to fear if you don't keep your connection with the one that's greater. But I'm telling you, you have nothing to fear when you understand greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. There's never been a more legalistic religious society than New England. And yet, as much, if not more, than any place in this nation, demon forces have found inroads. That's what I preached all day Sunday. Yesterday's faith and yesterday's performance does nothing for today's connection. The only hope we have, caught between the war in the heavenlies, between good and evil forces, the only hope we have is greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world. Well, how do you keep he that is in us in us? The Hebrews letter makes it clear. You are the house of God if you continue the same way you started. You get him in by a faithing act, not a perfecting act. You get him in by claiming a promise and hanging your body on it in the act. With the heart man believeth, with the mouth confession is made unto salvation, literally proclamation. And an imperfect being becomes the house of God's life, God's Spirit, God, the King. And greater is he that is in us at that moment. You keep him in by faithing every day. And the church destroys that connection by immediately transforming the faith act into a legalistic performance to get the approval of other Christians instead of a everyday renewal of that grab on heaven's promise. You keep the connection by faithing. You don't have to worry about demon forces. I've yet to find a faither. I've yet to find a faither. Oh, I find them going through the motions. Ritual and legalism. Anybody that understands the principle of Pauline faith, you don't have to worry. Two strong men won't occupy the same house at the same time. And God's Spirit. That was my quarrel with Pentecostals recently. They were casting demons out of Spirit-filled, Spirit-possessed people. They adjusted theology to experience. Problem was, those that said they were full of the Spirit weren't. They had demons, they weren't full of the Spirit. And the reason they didn't, they had substituted performance for faith. God stays in us the way he comes in us as we faith. That's why the message I'm preaching is equally important on this subject. You learn how to faith, you don't have to worry about these demons. You better get scared of them.
This is the end of Side 1. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 2. Thank you.